Singer, songwriter, producer William Bell was born in Memphis, Tennessee in 1939. He is most noted for his career at Stax, where he made such hit records in the 1960s as You Don't Miss Your Water, I Forgot to Be Your Lover, and his duet with Judy Clay, Private Number. As a songwriter, he wrote many of his own records and often partnered with longtime friend and label mate Booker T. Jones. Together, they wrote many songs for Bell and others, including Albert King's Born Under a Bad Sign. Following the collapse of Stax Records in 1975, William Bell worked in Atlanta as a record producer, although he did have a top 40 hit in 1976, Trying to Love Too. He continued to perform over the years and also recorded on occasion, including music for the 2014 motion picture Take Me to the River, where he and many others re-recorded some classic Stax songs. In 2016, William Bell returned to the reformed Stax Records with the album This Is Where I Live, produced by John Leventhal, who also co-wrote many of the album's songs with Bell. The album received the 2017 Grammy Award for Best Americana Album. I had the great pleasure of speaking with William Bell by telephone. How are you today?
I'm good, Chris. How are you?
Just fine, thanks. It's great to speak to you. I would like to start with your early days when you were young. How did you first find your voice as a singer?
In church, like most soul singers, I guess. I started out at an early age, about 7, in the church choir. And then around 8 or 9, I graduated solo and with the choir behind me. So started out in church in Memphis.
What was the church?
Central Baptist.
What singers did you emulate back then? When you were learning to sing, were there particular singers that you listened to and liked a lot?
Oh, yeah. I was always a fan of Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers. I liked their harmonies and actually Sam's voice, how he ad-libbed songs and lyrics and how he approached the lyrics. So I was always a big Soul Stirrers fan.
Growing up in Memphis, at some point you decided to make that crossover into secular music. Was that a tough choice for you?
Not really. It was like almost accidental. In high school, I was doing some singing to raise money for football uniforms and band uniforms and stuff like that in the auditorium. A friend of mine on a dare entered me into what they call a Mid-South talent contest that they had every year. And at the dare, I took it and won. So that's how I got into really doing the secular thing. And after winning the contest, one of the things was a trip to Chicago at the old Club DeLisa, and the band leader there called back to Memphis and told Phineas Newborn, which was another band leader in Memphis, that there's a kid from your hometown that you need to listen to. And so I started singing when I was like about 14 or 15 in this club, the Flamingo Room, on the weekends.
Your whole career on a dare, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was kind of funny.
Stax Records right there in Memphis. How did you find your way to Stax?
I had a vocal group called the Del Rios, and Stax was right in the heart of the neighborhood there. So Mrs. Axton had a record shop there, and she had speakers on the outside, so all the neighborhood kids would come up there to listen to the latest songs and the sounds, and she'd come out and ask us questions, why do you like this, or how does that sound to you? And I had a vocal group called the Del Rios that was working on the weekends with me, I had formed. And they needed some backup work done on Carla Thomas's Gee Whiz. And Chip Smolman, who was working with Stax at the time, was a producer and engineer there. So I saw him, and he asked me if we'd come in and do the background work for Carla. And so that's us on behind Gee Whiz.
So you're at Stax then in the early 60s, and you were there as a singer, but also as a songwriter. You wrote quite a few songs at Stax over the years. Is that where you got a toehold, so to speak?
Well, yes, it is. Actually, we went there as a vocal group, but I was always writing songs and writing poems and everything as escape, you know, my ideas and everything down. And later on, I started setting it to music and everything when I started working with the band. But we cut, as a Del Rios, we cut a couple of sides for Stax. And at one point, they were Satellite Records, and then they moved over to Stax. They took the S from Stewart, which in Miss Axton's last name, Axton, to make Stax Records because they were brother and sister and owned it.
So give us a picture. I have this romantic idea, I guess, of what Stax was like in the early 60s, that it was just this enormous creative extended family. Is that an accurate description, or am I putting too rosy a picture on it?
That is very accurate. We were like a family at Stax. I think that's one of the key ingredients that made us have the success that we had, because Jim, and you got to remember, this was during the time of starting segregation, even in Memphis and every place in the South. And Jim and Estelle being white, and most of the neighborhood kids and myself, David and Booker and Isaac, we were all little black kids and from the neighborhood there. But we banded together inside of the confines of Stax. We were like a family. And learned the craft, learned how to improve on it, and learned the ins and outs of recording and songwriting and all of that from that location at the Stax building. But we were like a family.
You were once quoted saying that compared to Motown in the 1960s, that Stax was basically raw energy, raw emotion, where Motown was more slick, more polished.
Absolutely. Motown was more, a little bit more, I guess you said, musically sophisticated than we were. We were right out of the streets into the church, right out of the church into the studio there. So our stuff was raw and basic for just a common person. And Motown, of course, wanted to appeal to mid-America, so they kind of polished theirs up a little bit to cross over and get the airplay from mid-America, because you got to remember that back in those days, you had what you called black radio. You didn't have that many. You only had two or three during the 60s. And so Motown was trying to appeal more or less to the white audience and to so that they could have more input with the radio.
And yet, I have to say, your voice compared to Otis or Wilson Pickett or Sam and Dave, you have a smoother sound, a more melodic-based sound than their singing styles in many of your records. Was that a conscious choice on your part?
Not a concentrated effort, but I think I was more of a hopeless romantic, and I love the ballads, and like I said, listening to Sam, and then as a young kid, I was kind of strange. I listened to Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, and Nat Cole, and all of those kind of records, and they appealed to me because I was a dreamer, and I liked the melodies, I liked the arrangements with all of the lush strings and all of that stuff. And so that appealed to me a lot more. I got into the harmonies and everything and the melodies when the doo-wop era came in. And so I could do up-tempo stuff, but I was more of a balladeer. And so my voice kind of fit that genre. And even with Stax, I was a little bit different from the Otis and the Sam and Daves and the Rufuses.
That Carla Thomas song, What a Fool I've Been, I believe you were one of the writers on that song, and I can hear what you're saying with the harmonies in that, and Every Day Will Be Like a Holiday, beautiful harmonies.
Oh, yeah. That was a song that Booker and I did. We initially had not done it to be a Christmas holiday song, but Al Jackson, the late Al Jackson, the drummer with the MGs, had the idea of adding the sleigh bells on it.
Oh.
And instantly it just developed into that holiday sound. And, of course, it made it one of the standard R&B Christmas songs.
Yeah, it sure is. So into the mid-60s, your career suddenly put on hold without your choice. What happened?
Well, I was drafted into the military, and I spent 2 years overseas. And, of course, when I came out, they had just started working with Otis, Rufus, and Sam and Dave. So all of these guys were the big stars at Stax, so, along with Carla. So I had to play catch-up. I was the lowest man on the totem pole when I got out. Huh. But, of course, they wanted my contract to run retroactively from the time I went in. So they had a couple of writers give me different songs and stuff. None of it just really fit my style of singing. And so I asked Jim if I could take about a month to just reorient myself into what the American music was doing at that time. And he said, of course, take your time. And so I wrote Everybody Loves a Winner, which was another ballad from that experience. And it became a big hit for me, so that got me back into the fold of the music.
And Eloise, hang on in there, is this wonderful up-tempo one, too. I love that song.
Yeah, I was doing up-tempo live, and so I think Booker and David and Isaac came to a show that I did at the Auditorium in Memphis, and they saw me doing this up-tempo stuff, the high energy and all that, and they said, why don't you record stuff like that? And so Booker and I sat down and tried to write something that would be more in line with that Stax energetic sound. So, and Eloise was one of those, yeah. And I think David and Isaac did Never Like This Before for me. And so everybody was saying, okay, well, you can do up-tempo, so we're going to put some up-tempo songs on you.
And then Soul of a Bell came out, your first LP after being there for nearly a decade, despite the Army. You finally got an LP out the door.
Right. It took a minute to me. They were releasing 45s to really reestablish me as an artist. Then I think around 67, we completed the Soul of a Bell, and the first LP for me.
Mm. I want to ask you about 1968, which I think is a tough year, not only nationwide, but certainly for Stax after Otis Redding's death and Martin Luther King's assassination and breaking with Atlantic Records, the bottom fell out. But Al Bell comes in and you suddenly have to absorb this new plan he's got to do a massive amount of recording, releasing a bunch of new albums across the roster. A really ambitious plan. How is that received at Stax?
It was really a trying time for us because losing one of our key players in Otis, and then Dr. King changed the whole element of the U.S. and the world with his death, and times were beginning to change a little bit for Stax. And of course, Stax at that time had disassociated themselves from Atlantic. Much to Jim's unhappiness, he found out that the contractual thing that when he left Atlantic, all of his catalog, his masters and everything reverted to Atlantic. So we had to really get a catalog together in a hurry. So for about a year there, we did nothing but record and write and record for different artists and sign on different artists to try to build up the catalog again. And it was a trying time for Stax because in a lot of ways they were structurally fighting for their lives, and then we were trying to hold on to key artists and all that stuff at that time.
Mm. But a lot of good material came out of that, too, including the Boy Meets Girl LP and your single with Judy Clay, Private Number, which is a really wonderful song in that theme of looking for my baby, searching for my baby. There are so many dozens of them, but this one's entirely different. It's a duet. It's a conversation, very different from all the others. What made you decide to make that song a duet?
Well, Judy was in the studio recording, and she didn't have enough material, so Jim asked me if I had a song, because I was always one of these artists that if I were not on tour, I was in the studio trying to learn all I could about production and engineering and all of that stuff, and learn the business background of the recordings. So he asked me if I had a song that Judy could do. So I had this one song with a verse and a chorus. I sang it for her. She liked it, but I didn't have the complete song, so we couldn't record it that day. So Booker said, well, we can go record it overnight and come back tomorrow. But Judy had to leave and go back to New York for some business reason. And so when we got back the next day, we had finished the song and laid the track, and I cut it with the full song. I did the full song. And we sent it to New York for Judy to put her voice on in New York. And Jerry Wexler or somebody had the bright idea that this would be a great song to compete with Marvin and Tammy.
Huh.
They used the vocal that I had done on the first verse and put Judy on the second verse and on the chorus with me, and made a duet out of it. And it became one of Stax's first pop hits that went on the pop charts and everything. Yeah. So we were able to compete with Marvin and Tammy on it.
Let me, at least if I understand this right, you didn't record it together. She just laid her vocals on top of yours.
Right. So we did not record it together. So, and thank goodness at that time, I know we had 8 tracks. We might have had 16, but I know we had at least 8 tracks. We had that many tracks so we could do some overdubbing. So for a long time, we only had 2 tracks and then 4 tracks because this was early days of recording.
In the 70s, you stepped away from the mic for a while. You got into producing more. What did you discover becoming a producer? It sounds like you were spending a lot of time in the late 60s watching the production at Stax. Was that a helpful skill?
Oh, it was very helpful, and I had a lot of people there that just were really, really kind. At Stax, it was like going to university for me. Tom Dowd, who worked for Atlantic, he would come in, and constantly I was in the studio there, and a person of his stature, you know, would having some artists come in asking all these questions. What does that fader do, or what does that knob do, and why does this voice sound better this way? But he was always kind enough to give us pointers and tell us what worked and what didn't work and how to do certain things, how to mic drums and all of that. So I got an education there at Stax. So after Stax kind of folded and we could all see the handwriting on the wall, Booker moved to L.A., I moved to Atlanta, and really was just disillusioned, you might say, with the business. And so I was thinking about going back to college and everything. So instead of doing that, I entered acting classes and things at the Academy Theater here in Atlanta and did some summer stock. But I was still producing and writing because my manager had some contacts with the people at Columbia and everything. So I did a production on a couple of other artists and had some success with it, and started writing and producing other artists and still touring, though. I was touring to earn a living because I had stopped recording up until 77 when Charles Fashion Mercury enticed me back in.
Yeah, that was a couple of nice sides you recorded then, Trying to Love 2.
Yeah, and I had some of my biggest success at Mercury. Trying to Love 2 was the first million seller that we had had.
I do want to jump forward to the present day because of your record in 2017. And congrats, by the way, on the Grammy. That's quite an honor.
Well, thank you. Thank you. That was quite a feat for me and for us, I say, because I was back on Stax, which was wonderful. It was like going home. But I got to work with John Leventhal, and he was easy to work with because he was a fan of mine, and I had done my homework and knew all of the stuff that he had done in the Americana genre of music. So it worked out for us, and we just kind of clicked and hit it off. And when I was working with him in the studio, it was just the relaxed, easy feeling, the same as it was that we did when we were at Stax with Booker and everything you and I were working. So it worked for us, and we took our time and just wanted to ensure that we had good lyrics on the songs, good story quality, and good melodic concepts, and wanted to not dwell on the Stax sound, but at least have some input on that energy and that horn element of the Stax sound. So, and that's what we did. Of course, we got a Grammy for it.
Yeah. So what's next for you? Have you got another record in the works?
We are in the writing stage now. You know, sometimes the creative energies and juices don't flow when we want them to. But and I've been so busy for the last couple of years after winning the Grammy. But now I am into a writing mode and doing some writing. I'm about 8 songs maybe into another CD project and all. So hopefully we will have one ready to go at the top of the year for 2019.
William Bell, thanks so much. And I want to say thank you for all of the music that you create. It's a real pleasure to have it around.
Well, thank you so much. My pleasure.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
That's Soul Village's conversation with singer, songwriter, and producer William Bell.